You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, cartoonist Linda Berry is helping Wisconsin students get creative, and she'll share her insights into inspiration for all of us. Now, there's that old saying, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't have two good things at once, I guess. Got it. So let's apply the saying to farmland, where the demands for surface area are getting more competitive between growing crops and generating electricity from solar panels. You can't do both at once, right? Well, our next guest says it is possible. Majdi Abunajim is an associate professor of soil biophysics at the University of California, Davis Department of Land, Air, and Water Resources. He's co-author of a study that appears in the American Geophysical Union publication, Earth's Future. Majdi, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob, and thank you for having me.
Before we get into your development here, can you talk a little bit about what you see as this concern that there might not be enough land to go around if we want to grow crops and put solar power in rural areas?
Thank you. Well, I love your introduction. I think agrivoltaics is the closest to having your cake and eating it. It is probably the best available method that remove this tension between energy groups and food groups over competing over land. And it shows that this does not have to be a zero-sum game.
And you use that word agrivoltaic. What do we mean by that?
Agrivoltaic is a marriage between two words, agriculture and photovoltaics, which is the technology used in solar farms to produce electricity from solar radiation. So this is basically the idea behind agrivoltaics is simple. It is maximizing the land potential by simultaneously co-generating food and energy at the same land.
Now, here's where it's tricky. If I put up a solar panel, I would assume it's going to block all the sun. So if I try to plant plants in the shadow of that, I'm out of luck. And that's where you're doing something different. What is different about these solar panels you're working with?
Great question. So yeah, it's all about harvesting solar light. And we want to maximize it, assuming that the solar radiation is the resource we're looking at and we want to make the best out of. What we discovered in our study, and we showed through modeling and validations, is that what plants want are basically photons. This is what they need for photosynthesis so that they can assimilate carbon and produce biomass. Photons are different depending on which light spectra they come from, and this is what causes the plants to feel thirsty or transpire. So if we use the low energy photons for plant production, that is the red band of the light spectrum, those are lower energy photons that will help photosynthesis without causing the plant to wanting to transpire more. And then on the other side, if we use the blue side of the solar spectrum for producing energy, those are the higher energy photons that will produce more kilowatt hours. So this is literally maximizing the potential out of every single photon on the light spectrum.
I want to make sure I have this right. I've got this solar panel. It's catching the blue end of the light spectrum and making energy out of that, but it's, I guess what, translucent? So the other part, the red stuff, is getting down to the plants that really want it?
Exactly. So this is the design that we're looking for. Those panels are still a concept. So we are working with different technology partners to see if we can do those. But we tested the concept with light filters, and we're actually getting great results.
Yeah, you tested those light filters. I think I read this right, with tomatoes.
We tested with tomatoes. Yes.
And what did you find? Were they hungry for more light, or did just the red light do it for them?
That's a great question. We are still in the phase of completing the data analysis, but we know that our yields were about 70% of what you would expect. But the good news is all the wastage we got this year, a lot of heat with temperatures reaching above 115 degrees Fahrenheit in California. And we got some bad tomatoes in the harvest. What we observed is that those filters help reduce those wastage by more than half.
You're hoping, so one side effect is it might cut wastage from heat. You're also thinking that a system, this agrivoltaic kind of system, could help with water use. What is your hope there?
Exactly. So it increases the water use efficiency because we're only providing enough light for for what the plants need. All the extra light is actually harvested for energy. And this makes the less light get into the plant. So we're basically optimizing per crop and per location how much is needed. And then the idea is let's harvest the extra for energy production.
All right, Majdi, I know you got some farmers there in California. We've got some here in Wisconsin too. If those farmers here are listening and saying, okay, this sounds pretty good, like how long would it be from where we are now to where an actual usable, practical pilot project might be available around the country?
We can start now. We don't have to start with those light splitting panels or agrivoltaic panels. Those might take a few years to be developed, but with shade. So when we start with the plant and the location, we know from plant physiology how much a crop needs. And then we know from the location how much light is there. And we can design the panel density over that land to be exactly how much we want to get rid of by producing electricity by that light.
And for these light separating panels now, where we could actually grow plants under our photocells, what's your next step in developing those?
I'm working currently with a few technology providers. We have a few designs that we want to test. I would say this is work in the making. Probably a year or two from today, we can produce and test those panels.
Majdi, thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Majdi Abunajim, Associate Professor of Soil Biophysics at the University of California, Davis. We talked to him about a recent study he co-wrote that found it's possible to generate solar power and grow crops on exactly the same plot of land. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about a county and its curious shape.
Joyce Salter Johnson has loved history her entire life. But as a descendant of people who were enslaved, her family history, like the history of many Black families across the country, was largely struck from the historical record. As WPR's Christine Hatfield tells us, Johnson had to take it upon herself to uncover her family's roots.
Who we are is determined by where we come from, our parents, where they come from, their parents, where their parents come from, and a chain of unbreakable links that could explain not only our genetic makeup, but also our personalities.
Joyce Salter Johnson's love of history started with a missing link in her family's history. She says her grandmother appeared to have no roots at all. She essentially lived alone in a nice house in the South that her grandfather sent money home to build while he worked on the Illinois Central Railroad. Johnson has always been a storyteller, and the holes in her family's history left room for her curiosity to thrive. When she reached adulthood, that curiosity transformed from fantasy into research. It took years to get answers to her family's story.
Before 1866, there was nothing written in any archive about slaves. Nothing. The information that you needed to find out about the enslaved person was in the archives or the databases or the journals of the people that held them enslaved.
Eventually, she traced the Salters back to 1792, when Hardy Salter was born to enslaved parents in Virginia. The journey of the Salters took them to Good Hope, Mississippi. That's where Joyce Salter Johnson grew up. Over the years, life led Johnson to Freeport, Illinois, and eventually Madison, where she's lived for more than 30 years. But it was Freeport's Historical Society that inspired Joyce's next historical endeavor.
So for years, we would always get these really nice publications about Freeport. And often it was a historic publication about Freeport. And there was never, ever one picture of any African American in those publications.
When she asked why, she was told there weren't records of African Americans living there, let alone pictures. So she began combing through the historical records herself, finding stories of centuries worth of Black settlers in the county.
In order for history to be accurate, it must present an inclusive record of all people. Unfortunately, in the past, a substantial portion of the history of the Negro in Stephenson County has been omitted. This omission has allowed generations of the county's residents, both black and white, to grow up with a distorted view of Stephenson County and the roles African American have played in its development. And that's what I had to give to them, and they said, of course we'll publish your book. I place people of African descent in that time and place, in that space, where they should have been automatically put in that space.
Johnson says she's glad to see her books as more than just family history. She says they're textbooks people can learn from. As for herself, life has carried on through the years of research and hard work. She found her way into early childhood education and led Madison's Early Childhood Learning Center, taking in children who needed extra care. At 82, her work isn't done just yet. She still has another book to write and more history to share with the world.
Joyce Salter Johnson of Madison is the author of numerous historical books. WPR's Christine Hatfield brought us her story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we search for the sources of inspiration and creativity with Wisconsin artist Linda Berry. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, where do you get your inspiration from? What does it take to get your creativity going? Our next guest has explored those questions in her own award-winning art and is helping students in Wisconsin find answers through their own work. Linda Berry is the creator of Ernie Pook's Comic, a comic strip that ran for 30 years. She's the author of the award-winning book Making Comics. In 2019, she received a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, also known as a Genius Grant. She's the former Chazen Family Distinguished Chair in Art at UW-Madison, and Linda is the 2023 Mackey Chair in Creative Writing at Beloit College, where she's a professor of interdisciplinary creativity. Linda, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you very, very much. Actually, I'm professor of interdisciplinary creativity at the UW. That's what I teach at the UW. And then in Beloit College, I'm there as an artist in residence.
Gotcha. Well, you always have a lot of irons in the fire, Linda. I'm not too surprised about that. Now, one thing, I want to start with something that I learned from talking to you a long time ago. I think in our lives a lot, we outsource creativity to the professional creatives, the artists and musicians. You are really hoping that we reclaim some of our creativity. Can you give us some encouragement to do that?
Well, you know, right now, I think the thing I'm the most interested in is what making drawings can be for people who gave up on drawing when they were little. Most people decide they can't draw at about, it's unfortunate, but it's at about 8 or 9 when they realize they can't draw a nose or hand. And then that's it. They just feel washed up. And for a lot of people, drawing just stops there. But one of the things I'm especially interested in is what happens if you bring drawing back in to the classroom in particular, if you bring it back in, but not with the aim of making a really good picture, but doing something like, for instance, bringing a classroom together. After, I think a lot of professors and teachers noticed that when the students came back after the pandemic break, people just had a hard time talking. They had a hard time getting together. They had a hard time just socializing in class. And I found out that if I asked them to close their eyes and draw a mermaid for 1 minute without opening their eyes, when they open their eyes, what they've drawn is so shocking and surprising and hilarious to them that the whole atmosphere of the room changes. So one of the things that people can do if they, you know, it sounds like it's not that big of a deal, but if you can close your eyes and draw something for 1 minute, you have to set a timer, you can't stop drawing. I always suggest that people start with a bacon and egg breakfast, because everybody seems to be able to draw that with their eyes closed. And when they open their eyes, they go, hey, I got something going on. And then the mermaid's always hilarious. Statue of Liberty is really good to draw with your eyes closed. So it's all these things that you kind of think you don't know how to draw. When you close your eyes, for people who gave up drawing a long time ago, they can draw longer without stopping with their eyes closed than with their eyes open. Because with your eyes open, you start to argue, like, that doesn't look like the Statue of Liberty. With your eyes closed, you're feeling in the dark. And so that's something that I'm really interested in, how drawing can transform the mood of the room and also the person who's drawing. Like, that to me is amazing. All you do is close your eyes and wiggle your pen for a minute, and when you open your eyes, you feel I had my students draw themselves as Batman today, just doing something that they do in the morning, you know, like Batman making toast or brushing their teeth with their eyes closed. And it was the same thing. It was like they all came in kind of tired. We drew ourselves as Batman with our eyes closed, and then the room was awake. So I find that amazing.
I think I see how that works, because you're talking to me. I gave up drawing. I'm terrible at drawing. But if if you said, Rob, draw something with your eyes open, I'd be like, I can't do it. If you told me, with your eyes closed, the pressure's off all of a sudden, right? Like, of course I can't draw something with my eyes closed, so yeah, I'll give it a shot. Is that the kind of response you get from this?
Well, it's actually more, it's deeper than that, because you can't not, first of all, feel kind of crazy when you're drawing with your eyes closed. It's sort of like me telling you to go into a dark room and feel around until you find the figurine of the cat that's in there. So if we filmed you doing that, you'd look pretty crazy. Actually, part of the reason I have people draw with their eyes closed is I just love watching people draw with their eyes closed. The whole class looks like it's dreaming, you know. But then when you open your eyes, it's a kind of surprise that's really wild, because it's so different than what you thought you were drawing. And just that, to get a charge from drawing, and the drawing itself isn't that important. I mean, the drawing itself isn't, I mean, you might want to keep it, you might want to throw it away. You don't have to do anything with it. You can put it in recycling. But it's really, what I've started to find out is, it really is this powerful, powerful thing. And for teaching creative writing, which I also do, you can do a thing where I can read you a story, a short story, and then I'll have you close your eyes and draw a scene from it. And it doesn't seem like anybody could really do that, except for everyone.
Okay.
I've almost never met anyone who can't do that.
I just did the mermaid thing with my eyes closed while you were talking. I got the hair pretty close to the head, actually.
No, that's why it's funny, is because your eyes are closed and then you lift the pen and it's like, where's the face supposed to go? And also, is she wearing like a shell bra? Like, what?
There's, I didn't
like,
get that
all
detail.
These things.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, that's it in a nutshell. It's just a strange little thing, but it does surprise people. Today, the other thing I had them draw with their eyes closed, which everyone can do, is a castle. A castle for 1 minute, or a cat. There are all these things that we know the shapes of, and we kind of know the outlines of, but we don't necessarily know that we know that until we give it a try.
I want to throw at you, before we run out of time, there's a line on your Tumblr blog that I really wanted to throw at you and have you expand on. You wrote on a piece of paper, drawing to have an experience rather than make a thing that is good or bad. And I don't know, that just really hit me as something really important. If we're not worried about, this is going to be a product that I'm going to like either be ashamed of or be proud to show people and do it for the experience. Can you talk about that for a couple minutes?
Sure. Like, say you go on a bike ride, right? And you go on this bike ride and you have a good bike ride and you come home and you feel like you had a really good bike ride. And then suddenly there's a knock on the door and it's the guys who drive the Google car.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, did you just take a bike ride? And you go, yes. And they say, how was it? And you go, I thought it was fantastic. And they say, well, let's review the film. So, or let's judge this bike ride by the tracks that your bicycle made. So there are two different things. One is you're in it and you're having a full body experience that actually can change your mood, versus this piece of paper that tells you you either did a great job of drawing that castle or you failed. And neither of those things give you much of an experience, except for an experience of never, ever wanting to do it again. You know, so there's just something to it. And at Beloit College, that's what I'm studying along with my students, because my students, for the most part, there are creative, or they're interested in creative writing. And so what I'm trying to show them is how drawing can help get you there. And also that there's something very similar about drawing and creative writing, in that they deal with images and they deal with your body. And they're very different than thinking, than trying to plan something out. It should feel a little bit like going on one of those funhouse rides at the carnival, or those horror rides. there should be a little bit of terror, but a good terror in it.
Linda, yeah. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you again.
It's so wonderful, and I want to just say hi to everybody out in their cars driving home. I listen to this show all the time, and it's just I'm thrilled to think that it's my little voice coming out of people's radios right now.
Well, it's good to hear you again, Linda. Thanks so much. That's Linda Berry, creativity expert, creator of the comic strip Ernie Pook's Comique, artist and teacher at UW-Madison and Beloit College. She joined us today to explore the energy of creativity. If you are the people out there in your car, don't try that eyes closed drawing trick just yet. I'm going to keep doing this. Do you get to see my mermaid? You do not. It's pretty good. Good shot. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we kick off a series of interviews with candidates in the election for Wisconsin's open state Supreme Court seat, and find out how Wisconsin's Focus on Energy program aims to help us conserve energy and get some ideas to help cut your winter heating bills. We'll talk about all that and more. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the new year has seen a lot of ups and downs in the electric vehicle market. The editor-in-chief of CarTalk.com joins us to explain the expansion of an electric vehicle tax credit and how that might set the stage for the rest of the year. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll round up the big stories in Congress, including negotiations or lack of them on raising the U.S. debt ceiling. First, on Friday, the Biden administration expanded a $7,500 consumer tax credit for electric vehicles made in North America. That tax credit raises the price limit for eligibility from $55,000 to $80,000. Last month, Tesla cut its prices on its EVs by up to 20%. Ford then dropped the price of their Mustang Mach-E. A Tesla executive said the price cuts were in part to make sure more of their models qualified for that federal subsidy. Some of those prices have wiggled back up again. So what do you need to know if you're going electric or just thinking about it? Our next guest is an auto industry expert with info on electric vehicles and all those other cars. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you looking to buy an electric vehicle, mulling the concept, dead set against it? Do you already have one? Do you wonder if electric vehicle or hybrid or plug-in hybrid is right for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jamie Page Deaton is editor-in-chief for Car Talk. Jamie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
I gave a Cliff's Notes version of the jumps and drops in prices lately. What's the latest on what electric vehicles are going to cost people?
You know, it honestly depends on who you ask. Some people are saying, oh, this is the beginning of the EV price wars, where automakers are going to drop their prices and finally EVs are going to be much more affordable. And other people are saying, meh, this isn't all that much different. You know, automakers have to worry about their profit margins. And if they all start, you know, slashing prices and things like that, then they're not going to make any money on EVs. And so the price drops really aren't coming. But this really does come on the heels of the new tax credits that are available for EVs. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting with, you know, the Tesla Model Y that you mentioned is they initially dropped the price because it was it was classified as a car, but then they got it reclassified as an SUV and raised the price again. So it really kind of depends on what kind of electric car you're getting. Are you getting a car, or are you getting an SUV? That's going to help determine whether or not you're eligible for these tax credits.
Let's talk about that tax credit a little more. I think you and I have talked about it. It's come up on the show in the past, and the deal was some people could take advantage of this new-ish tax credit passed by Congress. There were lots of asterisks. It's easier to get it now, it sounds like.
It is. The general Cliff's Notes version of it is how much you're able to get in this tax credit depends on a couple of things. One is, of course, the price of the vehicle. If the vehicle is too expensive, then you're not going to get the tax credit. The other thing that determines how much you can get back is how much of the vehicle is assembled in the U.S., because Congress and the Biden administration really want to reward automakers who bring manufacturing back into the United States. So there are some EVs that'll let you claim the full amount because they're fully assembled in the United States. And then there are other EVs where you won't get any amount of the tax credit because they aren't assembled in the United States. So this is one thing where it really pays to do your homework before you buy if you're interested in this tax credit. Also to add, this tax credit in comparison to old EV and hybrid tax credits can materially lower the price of the vehicle. It used to be that you had to pay full price for the vehicle and then you got the tax credit on your taxes, which is still a savings, but unless you're paying, you know, cash for the vehicle, it's not something that a lot of people would really notice, you know, in their vehicle financing. Now what you can do is say you get the full tax credit, you can transfer that tax credit to the dealer you buy the car from, and in turn, they will give you the discount right there off the price of the car. So you won't be able to claim that on your taxes, but you'll have, you know, less to finance on the car, which can end up saving you money overall.
Talking to Jamie Page Deaton, editor-in-chief at Car Talk, looking at cars, electric vehicles in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, decisions you've gone through lately or are about to. Your questions, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. My lease is up next year, and I'm loyal to my brand as a consumer. I drive Volkswagens, and I'm planning to get the ID Buzz, which is the newfangled Volkswagen bus. And I'm setting up the infrastructure now so I can transfer my lease next year to Volkswagen bus. I'm very excited about it, and I'm hoping to see it at the Chicago Auto Show next week.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Jamie, do you have any words on the VW electric bus?
Yes, this is one that is so cool. Excellent choice, Jeff. This is basically, I mean, in my mind at least, the ID Buzz has a potential to make minivans cool again, because it looks like the old hippie VW buses modernized, you know, for this century, and it's all electric. So they've got some really fun, cool color combinations, really flexible interiors. And this is a great way to move a lot of people without using a whole lot of gas. Now, the one thing to notice is it's not going to be built in the U.S. So this is one where you might not get the full-on tax credit that you would get with some other vehicles. But that doesn't mean that it's still not a great choice for people.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Jaron joins us now in Madison. Jaron, hi. Are you there?
Hi. Am I on?
You are on. Go for it.
Oh, I thought you said Jared.
Oh, what is it, Sharon? I think I had a typo here.
Yeah, Sharon.
Sharon.
Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense, honestly, than what I saw. What did you want to bring up, Sharon?
So I had been researching new cars because of the age of my vehicle and had decided on electric. And then my car got totaled because of the age of it. And I, of course, had to find a vehicle in a very short amount of time. By then, I'd ruled out a total electric because I'm probably going to move from my private residence to a condo. And I wasn't sure whether they'd have electric charging.
Oh.
So I decided on a hybrid, but there wasn't a hybrid to be found for hundreds of miles. So I ended up getting a regular car.
Oh.
So, and I think being able to charge your car is a big issue.
Sharon, thanks a lot for that call. Jamie, Sharon hit some key points here. You could plug in your hybrid overnight. Well, great if you have your own garage and your own outlets there. People at apartments and condos, that might be an open question.
It might be. I mean, I know that a lot of apartment complexes and condos are adding charging stations because that's something that their residents are demanding. And so, Sharon, if you're moving to a condo, I know you already have a fully gas car, but once you're established in the condo community, maybe work with the condominium board to get some chargers added, because that could potentially add significant value to the condos and the property as more and more people, you know, adopt electric cars. But, you know, that ability to charge and that range anxiety is a real issue for a lot of people. So me, for example, I don't own an EV, but I often get EVs to test. I don't have a charger in my house because honestly, my electrical panel is not up to it and we're not ready to spend the money to upgrade the panel. So I have to go and charge these vehicles kind of out and about in the wild. Now, if this is a situation you find yourself in, one thing you can look at is how quickly the vehicle can charge at a level two charging station. So there are some vehicles that can get to an 80% charge, you know, in as little as 20 or 30 minutes. So if there's a charging station at, say, your local grocery store or your local Starbucks, you can go in, get your shopping done, and get most of your charging done. I know the mall near me actually has a number of charging stations. So what I will often do is plug the car in, go run my errands. I come back and I'm at like 85, 95% charge and I'm good to go. So there are options out there. It's just that none are quite as easy as just plugging it in your own personal garage.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. Sharon also mentioned, and I've heard this from other people, looking for a hybrid in an area, and you know, the model you want may exist somewhere on this planet. It is not at a dealership anywhere near you. What kind of availability issues are you seeing for not just EVs, but various kinds of hybrids as well, Jamie?
Well, the issue that we're seeing now is there's still a lot of battery shortages. US-based automakers are starting to try and take control of their supply chains, and that means that they need to work with battery makers. You know, currently, most batteries for EVs and hybrids are made overseas. And so when we have things like COVID, when we have other supply chain disruptions, that's really hard to get the batteries that you need to build the cars. So both General Motors and Ford are looking at bringing in battery plants and using minerals within the US to actually build the batteries. They're not going to come online until the, you know, 2024, 2025. So you can expect that it's going to be a little bit tough to find hybrids and EVs in the near term. Longer term, that's going to ease up quite a bit. The other thing that is constraining supply is, you know, in 2021 and previous years, hybrid and EV sales were rarely more than, you know, 3% of overall new car sales. In 2022, sales jumped 65%. So they went up to 5%, a little bit over 5% of all new car sales. And what that means is automakers really weren't prepared for this surge in interest in hybrids and EVs. And so they hadn't really ramped up production. And of course, ramping up production for them does take a significant amount of time. They have to retool and refit plants if they want to open up another assembly line, things like that. So there are going to be constraints on the supply of, you know, electric and hybrid vehicles in the near term. But that said, if you can be flexible about, you know, what you want, if you aren't, say, married to a certain color or married to a certain model, then you will probably have a little bit of better luck in finding what you're looking for.
Talking to Jamie Page Deaton, editor-in-chief for Car Talk, looking at the ups and downs of the electric vehicle market, and we're throwing some hybrids in there too as we move on into this new model year. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you looked for an EV or a hybrid of some sort? Did you find the one you wanted? Did you end up getting it? What kind of things did you weigh comparing one to the other? Do you have questions for Jamie? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jamie Page Deaton, editor-in-chief of Car Talk. We're looking at the expansion of a consumer tax credit for electric vehicles, recent price fluctuations, and the future of the EV industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you looked at, shopped for electric vehicles or various kinds of hybrids? What are you seeing? What do you like, not like? What do you want to know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. I'd seen tell online of, I believe it was Fisker that's developed a model where there's a solar panel on the roof. And I'm wondering, like, what sort of charge that generates, how far that sort of technology has come, or if it's something where we need to wait for bugs to get worked out.
Randy, thanks for calling. Rooftop solar in our cars, Jamie.
That is a great question, Randy, because it seems to make sense, right? You should have a solar panel on your roof and the car can, you know, drive as long as it's sunny out. The reality is that those panels don't generate enough electricity to really provide a whole lot of range or a whole lot of power. The thing to remember is, you know, EVs and honestly all cars are super heavy. And so it takes a lot of energy to move them forward. That's why, you know, the batteries in EVs are so big. Usually the entire floor of an EV is an entire, you know, battery pack. And frankly, like, those solar panels are simply not big enough to provide enough charge. The company that actually started first with solar panels on the roof of the car was Toyota with their plug-in Prius hybrid. And those solar panels could generate enough electricity to basically precondition the car before you got into it. So it could run the, you know, if you were stopped and you were parked, it could run in hot weather, it could run the air conditioner a little bit, or, you know, maybe put in a little bit of hot air if it was cold. But right now, that type of technology is a little bit of a gimmick. That doesn't mean that as solar technology improves, that it won't ever be, you know, something that we see on cars. But I would say that it's going to be a lot longer there, Randy, than waiting for the bugs to get worked out. It's going to require a lot more changes in how much energy, you know, small solar panels can produce before we're going to see it as a way of actually providing propulsion for the car.
Randy, and I'm thinking about, you know, getting the snow off the top of my car the other day. I would be real gentle if I knew that was solar panels instead of just the roof of the car. I don't know. That would be another problem to solve. Thanks for calling in, Randy. Albert joins us now in Illinois. Albert, hello.
Hello.
Oh, what did you want to bring up, Albert?
My question is the road tax on these cars. Gasoline, you have to pay taxes on that for the road, so how are you going to tax the electric cars to keep the roads in shape?
Albert, thanks for the call. And I know here in Wisconsin, Jamie, I can't remember the amount, but there is a bump in your vehicle registration fee for electric because exactly of that gas tax issue Albert's talking about. Is that something you're seeing around the country?
Yes. So Albert raises a great issue, which is that for a long time, you know, hybrids and electric cars have been getting essentially a free ride. Like, not only have they been getting tax credits from the federal government, some state governments, and some municipalities, but they also don't use as much gas. So they aren't paying as much for the wear and tear that they do on the roads. And so what we're seeing in some states is an increase in their vehicle registration fees to offset the loss of the gas tax fees, but not all states are doing it. And, you know, the question that a lot of people are wrestling with is that, you know, a lot of states want to encourage EV adoption because it's better for the environment, but they really do need to balance that with the need to, you know, get the tax revenue to maintain their roads. So that's an issue that a lot of states are grappling with, though most have leaned into adding a little bit to the registration fee to make up for the loss there.
Thanks for the call. Rob is with us now in Verona. Rob, hi.
Hi. I had a question pertaining to charging stations, and in the future, when there's a lot of vehicles that are electric, and, like, for instance, now Teslas have proprietary plugs, and it seems that the industry is going to have to go to a standardized plug. Is there any talk about that?
Ooh, interesting. Jamie?
Yeah, actually, Tesla is opening up their charging network so that different types of vehicles can use it. And you just have to get a little bit of an adapter for your plug. It's similar to, like, when you go overseas and you bring an adapter for all of your charging cables so you can plug it into the wall there. But yes, this is a really big question that needs to be solved. And it's not so much about, although, you know, the availability of charging stations, although that is a key part of it, but it's really up to, you know, battery scientists and EV manufacturers to really improve the speed at which these EVs can charge. Because think about it, even if you go to a gas station with, like, 20 pumps, it's going to turn over about, each pump is going to turn over about every 3 minutes or so. Now, if you go to a, charging station, even if there are 20 charging stations, if each one of those stations is taking 20 minutes and they're all taken, you can expect to wait a really long time. And some people, and I would say a lot of American drivers, since we're so used to just pulling in, filling up and going, are not going to want to put up with that. And so really what we see a lot of automakers focusing on now that we have EVs that can easily handle, you know, a range of 300 miles is getting that charging time down so that visiting a charging station is similar in experience to filling up with gas. So like Sharon was saying, you know, and I mentioned going and doing your shopping while you charge your EV, they're really working at getting it fast enough so that you just kind of need to plug it in like you would, fill it up like you would with gas, where it only takes maybe 3 to 5 minutes to get the charge you need. But that definitely is an issue, is building out not only the charging infrastructure, but also making sure that the cars can charge quickly enough so that you aren't parked there for 20, 30 minutes.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jamie Page Deaton, editor-in-chief for Car Talk, looking at the state of the art with electric vehicles. Back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Rob. So Bob Ballard, the guy who discovered the Titanic, has created a prototype of a buoy that would float in water that has a spring inside to produce kinetic energy. I guess my question is why the auto industry isn't looking at doing something similar inside a vehicle so that as we're actually driving from the bumps on the road, it would actually produce energy, and that could be then somehow kind of acting like an alternator to be fed back into the battery to provide a charge.
Interesting, Marcus. So like we get energy from brakes. Now, Jamie, if you drive on my hometown dirt road in Michigan, could we harness the energy of all the bumps?
I don't think anyone would want to ride on the roads that you would need in order to make enough energy. Because, you know, when you're thinking about a buoy and those, you know, a wave on the ocean, you know, you're talking about like 6 feet-ish when you have a buoy going up and down to make enough energy there to provide that kind of electricity. So right now, most of the energy recapture that you see in hybrids and EVs is within the brakes. But in terms of capturing energy through motion, I haven't seen anybody working on that. And the main reason that I would guess that is because you would require so much motion in order to get enough energy that it would, I think, really make, you know, car sickness go through the roof on people and just be really hard on people's backs, because you would have to bounce around quite a bit. That said, that doesn't mean that nobody's working on it. I'm just not aware of anybody.
Marcus, thanks for that call. Jamie, I want to take a couple minutes to look at the market now. What makes and models do you have your eye on, whether it's Tesla or everybody else?
Well, I mean, I'm looking more at everybody else, because Tesla is great, but the fact remains that they're losing market share. You know, they used to have 72% in 2021 of all EVs sold. Now in 2022, they were down to 65% of all EVs sold. And, you know, Tesla is still a great success story because they've pushed the entire industry and really the entire world towards EV adoption. But if you look at how Americans specifically like to live our daily lives, I really like the Ford F-150 EV. That's the F-150 Lightning. I mean, I think I've talked about it on the show before, but this is a truck that is really doesn't require you to make any compromises, with your lifestyle. You can tow with it, you can haul with it. It works great in the cold. It's got a great lockable frunk, so a front trunk, since there's no engine there, which is a big, you know, big, if you're a truck owner and you've tried to get, you know, groceries home, or, you know, have done a Costco run and you're trying to get home in the rain, it'd be great to have some good covered storage there. The other ones that I've got my eye on is the Kia EV6. And that is a great kind of small crossover SUV, very easy to live with, great small city car. And then I'm also a huge fan of plug-in hybrids. These I think are the bridge vehicles that'll take us from where we are now, where we're, you know, as a country, largely dependent on gasoline, to where we're using primarily EVs while we're waiting for that infrastructure and that charging time to kind of catch up with people's lifestyles. Because most of these plug-in hybrids, you know, you can get 30 to 50 miles of all electric range, which is great for your everyday life. And then when you're on a road trip, you don't have to worry because you've got a gas engine to back yourself up. The other thing that is super fun about these is in a lot of cases, automakers have tuned them for performance. So one of my absolute favorites is the Volvo V60 Polestar. So this is a Volvo station wagon that has a little over 500 horsepower. So if you want to talk about kind of a sleeper car right there, it's a plug-in hybrid and it goes super fast and you can drive around town on all electric power, but you've got that gas engine backing you up when you want to go farther than that.
Jamie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Jamie Page Deaton with Car Talk, joining us for a look at the latest in the electric vehicle market. Coming up, we'll round up the top stories in Congress, including that debt ceiling. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.